I'm Wolf Harand, Oscar Echo, One Whiskey Hotel Charlie from the Documentary Archives Radio Communication in Vienna. And I'm talking to Glenn Johnson, Whiskey Zero Golf Juliet, co-leader of the K1N Navassa, the expedition that just finished. Ken, thanks for talking again to us. And let us first of all briefly sum up the results. You had 140,000 contacts, 35,000 uniques, which means that a great majority worked you on more than one band or mode.
Our target was 100,000 contacts. We figured that with the time and resources that the Fish and Wildlife Service would allow us on the island, our goal was 100,000 contacts. And we really worked hard to get a team that we call shovelers, really hard workers. And we ended up with just a few cues over 140,000. So we were extremely pleased with the results of that, Wolf.
Were the propagation conditions good, better, or worse than expected?
They were about what we were expecting. We thought that we might have to put this off for another year, and we're on the downslope of the sunspot cycle. 10 meters was really good for us. We had propagation on all the bands, and the low bands were, fortunately for us, at least with some receiving antennas, were very good and quiet, and we could make a lot of contacts on the low bands as well. So the timing for propagation was very good because we took advantage of the low bands as well as the highest bands of all. So we were very pleased with our propagation results. And we had good long windows to Europe. Our windows are never long enough for Asia and Japan, but we did work about 2% more Asians than we did on Desecheo a few years ago. And numbers from Europe, I think, were a little bit higher. And when we look at the ham populations of the number of people in Europe and North America, the percent that we worked were just about within just a couple percent of what the ham population is. So we really, I think, did a good job of balancing out our numbers. However, Asia has a lot more hams, probably as many hams as Europe and North America combined, but because they are propagationally challenged from the Caribbean, our numbers were still quite low, not as high as anyone on both ends would like, but that's all the propagation that we had, and we took advantage of it as much as we possibly could.
Africa, 177, Oceania, 1,200, South America, 3,200, Asia, 8,000. But now, what explains that you spent more time for Europe with a total of 44,900 contacts, 32%, and less time for North America, but with almost twice as many contacts, 81,000 or 82,000, 58%?
Well, it's all in rate. It was very, very fast working the United States, North America, and many other countries. We could work very, very fast, making 300, even sometimes the rates would go up to 400 contacts an hour is what the rate meter would say. And when we would focus our attention on Europe or the propagation was to Europe, our rates would be a fraction of that. We were very lucky to get 100 or 125 contacts an hour from Europeans.
But why? Do you have any idea why there is such a difference? Is it mentality, operational skills, code of conduct between some of the Europeans? Or we shouldn't blame all of them?
A lot of it is the code of conduct, and there might be some language barrier, but a lot of it is just DXing skills, I think, and just listening. The most important thing, if you want to get into the log, is to listen and find out where the DX station is listening, because you want to get into the log and you want to transmit where he's listening. And if you just call and call and call and don't take a break, I, as the DX operator, will just tune on by because I'm interested in rate and getting people into the log. And so listening is very important. It was so obvious that when we would answer a contact, and if you'd give me 5-9, immediately there'd be a huge pileup on your frequency, and it would be impossible to pick out a call sign. And so if you just jump on the frequency of the station that was just worked, it's impossible. You're not going to get in. So we were constantly tuning. We would either be moving up or we'd be moving down. And so jumping to the side of the last contact gives you far, far better opportunity to get into our log.
Then was DQRM, deliberate disturbance, was it restricted to Europe? And was your DQRM tracking project effective?
We were so busy on the island, we were either either operating or eating or sleeping, and we didn't really have a lot of good communication or fast communication. We had a very rudimentary and fairly expensive satellite email system, so we didn't really have, we couldn't look up on the internet and search the internet for things. So we didn't really have a lot of immediate time feedback on our DQRM. I don't think it was strictly limited to Europe. I think there were North Americans, and I know there were South Americans bothering us. When our rates would start to slow down, when we realized our transmit frequency was being interfered with, we would move a little bit up or down or switch to or make a large jump to go to a different frequency band. The last 2 days, we really tried to stay on 20 meters and work all-time new ones. And we were very, very focused on that. And unfortunately, there were a couple times we just had to give up because we would announce our transmit frequency and within seconds, someone would be jamming either our transmit frequency or our listening frequency, so we couldn't hear. So that was very frustrating. And, you know, it's certainly somebody was having their fun, but the real thrill of and spirit of ham radio was being interfered with, and that certainly is not very nice.
Well, this will be a question for the national organizations, the ham organizations, to consider whether or not to counteract these things. But now, Glenn, all the deserving, all the happy ones want to know, when will the logs be on LOTW and when will the printed QSLs be available?
There have already been several thousand logs uploaded to LOTW, and we did not advertise this, but those that contributed any amount prior to the de-expedition starting had their LOTWs uploaded right away. And our contributors are in the priority to get our QSL cards out. As soon as we get our cards printed, which hopefully will be in the next 2 or 3 weeks, as the cards go out, the LOTWs will go up. Our contributions before the de-expedition just about exactly met the monetary needs that we had before we started the de-expedition, because we had an incredible amount of upfront costs for our transportation and for our fish and wildlife food that had to all be paid in advance. And now we have all of the de-expedition expenses to pay. And I think the early reports are that the OQRS income is coming along fairly well. But we hope to be able to upload all the LOTW logs within the next few months.
Okay, let this be an appeal that it's never too late to donate. Glenn, let's come to another point. Why do you do it? Why do you risk and raise more than $300,000? Why do you spend months and years in preparation and finally another month at the spot? Is it not a silly job to say 140,000 times 5-9, okay, 5-NN?
Sir Edmund Hillary, when he went to ask why he climbed Mount Everest, it's because it's there. And we have probably the same impetus, just in a different realm. It's because it's there, and because, you know, we can give out, you know, someone, give to someone or contact that's in the most needed locations. It's like a lot of things, you know, it's fun being there, making all the contacts, but a lot of the fun is in the planning and staging and, you know, just in the preparatory work and working with a team. We work really hard to... Team criteria selection was number one, compatibility. We all have to know our team members and know that we work together well. We don't have any incompatibility. accountability issues or people that are, I'll say, independent thinkers that do their own thing and that cause trouble for us. But compatibility is number one. We want a good team that's compatible. We pick a team that has good operating skills, trilingual meaning fluent in CW, RITI, and sideband. And then we have contribution skills. There might be somebody who is not good at sideband or doesn't like sideband or somebody who only operates CW. Well, we will consider them and maybe take them if they have skills in logistics or IT or antennas or power distribution and other, contribution skills, we call it. And another thing we learned from this expedition is, minimum viable configuration. Because of our severe weight limitations, we found out that we can get by with just minimal things. So, we can live on MREs for a couple weeks and not take a lot of overhead for kitchen and cooking. We learned that we can get by with very little and focus on what needs to be done. But it's mostly, it's the thrill of being able to give out number one. I'd like to be home and work, fill up my band slots too, but it's really, really fun to be in the other end, and you can feel the thrill and excitement when somebody claps and yells thank you, and it makes it all worth it. There were actually several hams that we worked. It was their very first country outside of their home country. There were a couple, I did not work one, but a couple guys said they worked a ham. It was their very first contact. So if you make your first contact, your first country with an entity that's number one most wanted, it's really a thrill on both ends. So that's why we do it, just for a number of factors, and it's because it's there and we can do it.
Just by the way, Glenn, do you have Navassa in your own log?
I have Navassa from a previous expedition years ago, yes.
Yeah, so you are a happy one. Final question, Glenn. Would you do it again? And will you do it again?
The hardest thing to do was to turn off the radio that last morning with a huge pileup of Asia on 80 meters. That was very hard to do, and it was as strong as it was the first day. I found it very difficult to leave. Several of the team members were ready to go home, but I had worked so hard with our planning for the last 12 years, 15 years, to go. It was very, very difficult for me to leave. And I would really like to go back. And Fish and Wildlife says they're going to consider applications in 10 years. So I'm going to be getting, I might have to go in my wheelchair, but I'd certainly like to go. But yes, we're going to, there's always something in the plans. We haven't started really thinking about what's next yet because we're just in the recovery mode from this. But we do have a couple things up our sleeve that we might be going to in the next two or three years.
Glenn, thank you ever so much for talking to us. Thank you very much for doing such a wonderful job. Thanks to all of you. I was talking to Glenn Johnson, Whiskey Sierra Golf Juliet, the co-leader of the K1N Navassa Expedition, and Wolf Harant, Oscar Echo 1 Whiskey Hotel Charlie, of the Documentary Archives Radio Communications in Vienna.